This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Everybody, and a welcome to a very special episode of the What's Good Games podcast. I'm Andrea Renee, joined in studio by Miss Christine Steimer.
Oh, hello.
And Miss Brittany Brombacher.
Hello.
And as you can see, we have a very special guest joining us today. Corey Barlog is here from Sony Santa Monica.
Yay.
So good to finally get you here.
Yes, I'm very excited. What is good?
We have been trying to get you on the show for what feels like almost a year.
Yeah, I mean, I've been dodging your calls as best as I could.
But I knew it.
Then you called from a block number, and I answered, and here I am.
I hoodwinked you, and I'm very proud of my schemes. No, but it's great to see you, and you're obviously here in town for the Game Developers Conference 2019.
Yes.
And I hear you're nominated for a few more awards this week. That's exciting.
It is exciting. It's crazy. This has been a very wild year for everybody at Santa Monica.
So we saw you at DICE recently, where, of course, you were on stage quite consistently. I think that was one of the key Twitter jokes of the night, was just how many times Corey was on stage.
Yeah, you just want to chair it. Yeah.
What's funny is we were in the backstage, too, and there wasn't really anybody sort of running that. So when they announced it, it was, I think, Jordan, who was sitting backstage, who was like, "Hey, dude, I think you have to go back on stage."
That's very hilarious.
I like the camera in the front, like, looking for you. It's like, right. Where is he? Oh, he's backstage.
Just, as we said, give him a chair on stage. But seriously, congratulations on all of the success. Obviously, we love God of War here at What's Good Games. It was our game of the year for last year.
Oh,
had a lot of fun playing it. So we thought it'd be fun to talk to you a little bit, of course, about the game and about what you're doing here at GDC this week. So we pulled some questions from our fans on Twitter, which we're going to get to in just a few minutes. But what has it been like now that it's been almost a year since the game launched, kind of like reflecting on the journey that you and the studio have gone through?
I am still exhausted. It's wild. Like, I feel like I'm getting more tired with all of this.
It must be all these podcast appearances.
Right. Yeah.
I think it's all the awards because he has to carry them like on his back.
Yeah.
Oh, that's how you stay in shape.
Right.
I have to keep care. Yeah, you're required actually to keep them on your person at all times.
That makes sense.
Which makes it very difficult to travel. It's incredible and it's humbling that people like the work that we're doing. There's a lot of, I think, inherent pressure that comes from each new award, which sounds stupid. It sounds like a dumb flex, but like the reality is it just puts that pressure of like, all right, you gotta keep one-upping, you know. I think we all get caught up in that concept. I got caught up in that on God of War 2. Not God of War 2, like if we're doing another one, but like the original God of War 2.
Right.
My naming convention is super confusing. Isn't it?
I wasn't gonna say it.
Yeah. I blame myself on that one. But yeah, that you know, God of War went so well, I think I felt an incredible amount of pressure to kind of at least keep up. I didn't feel that realistically I could top what we had done on the first one. So I think it's a hello old friend kind of moment now where I do feel happy, but, you know,
tired.
No small amount of pressure. And yeah, an incredible amount of tiredness is wild. I think when I finished 2... I was tired for about a year. It took me almost a year to sort of recover from all of that. And it's coming on a year now. So I'm really hoping that year hits and all of a sudden I'll just feel vibrant and energetic.
Well, I hope you get some rest as well, but it sounds like you guys just keep having reasons to celebrate.
I know, right?
I mean, which is, you know, do you guys have parties after every big award show win?
Not like really.
Cake or something? Simon just wants to hear in detail the food you eat.
Where are the baked goods? Where do those factor in?
Everybody does bring in baked goods every once in a while to the studio. I have these amazing tacos that this guy Artie makes. They're like on Thursdays, they have these sort of Taco Thursdays, and he makes these homemade tacos, and they are astounding. I'm not much of a foodie, right? I don't talk much about food, but these things are life-changing. They're amazing.
Now right? I feel like a studio visit
right.
is in
a
order.
Thursday studio
a Thursday
visit is the time you want to come, right? It's pretty amazing.
Well, you are going to be speaking here at GDC. You have a talk called Reinventing a God of War.
Yes.
So can you talk to us, maybe give us a little sneak peek or a preview about what you're planning to speak about?
So I'm going to give you a little insight into my process, which actually is sort of the story of the talk that I'm doing, which is I don't have it done. I have to do it on Friday, and I still am figuring it out. I kind of am in that, like, you know, study for the exam the night before. I've actually been working on it for a while. It's very hard for me to do these kinds of things because essentially it's a talk about, like, what I learned on God of War, what the process was of directing something like this. And every time I do it, I keep feeling like, why does anybody want to listen to this? You know, you get about halfway through it and you're like, I don't want to, like, other people do their job differently. Who cares about the way I did it? But, you know, I have to keep telling myself that I learned a lot about my job by hearing about how other people did their job, right? And not really the clinical, like, first I did this, then I did this, but just sort of stories from moments in time, right? When they're faced with a really difficult challenge and how they sort of deal with it, right? There's a great story about James Cameron when he was shooting the Ghost of the Abyss documentary, which is the Titanic one. And he had to get Bill Paxton and all these scientists together, and then they had to get a boat, and then they had to go out to the wreckage site, which is like a day and a half or 2 days of sailing, I guess. It's a motor-powered boat, so it's not sailing. But they go out there, right?
Sorry.
What's that?
I just did a little song.
Every once in a while, that's
Stimer's
good.
It's Stimer's thing.
Stimer's just breaking out in a song. So they get out there, and it's late at night, and they need to take the submersible. So they're like, oh, we'll take it and put it in the water. The crane that picks a submersible up off the deck over the railing and puts it in the water is broken. So everyone's kind of freaking out. It's late. They've been traveling for several days. Everyone's getting a little hot and testy. And so Cameron's just like, all right, you know what? Let's just go to bed. Let's wake up in the morning. We'll figure this out fresh, right? But he stayed up all night. And he stayed up all night figuring out the sort of monetary cost that it would be if he were to cancel and then rebook, because you'd have to rebook everybody to come back there. They'd have to rebook the ship. They weren't able to extend the time. Everybody had a small window. Versus cutting out a side of the ship where the railing is and rigging up a system of pulleys with ropes to actually use the crane and drag just slightly over the deck the submersible and then put it in the water. So all night, he worked out these plans. So everybody wakes up in the morning. He's got the solution, presents it to everybody, and says, all right, we're going to try this. And it worked. And they were able to sort of salvage that shoot.
How did they get it back out of the water? That seems like the most important
I don't know.
Part.
That's not the story.
Like you're telling us. You're like, oh, we can just cut out a side of the boat and like kind of push it off the boat. And I'm right. Like, that part is I get.
Gravity
but
does
I
most of the work there.
Get back out without
yeah,
the crane.
I think they were able to request a ship to come out so that when they were done shooting,
okay.
they were
they
able to pull it back out of the water. Yeah,
okay.
So they got a ship that maybe had a crane to pull it back out of the water. But
it seems like a future James problem.
Yeah. That's not a that's
like,
not a this
in the water,
story
we
problem.
We can just like motor the submissive or submersive back to the
yeah.
mainland. How
yeah, much they could probably for 2 days drag it behind. Right, it's kind of like a camper. Right, that would be pretty good. It would be the person who performed the poorest during the show. So that way they'd be like, you got to ride in the submersible. I'm sorry.
Oh my gosh.
That would be fantastic.
The shortest straw to draw.
Right. But I mean, that story right there made me realize like, oh, okay. That sort of describes what you need to do. I think in most of these situations is that it's not always a situation where you're coming up with the solution, but you have to really throw yourself into every problem. Right. And that's essentially what making games is in general is just a series of interconnected problems every single day over and over and over and over and over and over again. And eventually it wears you down and you go crazy, but then you get pulled back out because you have a great team of people who are not going crazy at that moment. They had gone crazy the week before.
Right.
So you pull them out
you
of that.
All take and then, turns.
Exactly. I think we kind of have a little number like at the deli or something like that.
It's my turn to be crazy this week.
Right? Because it is definitely a high pressure thing. Even when it's not high pressure, there's always something going on because it's completely unknown. I think that's the essence of what we're doing is nobody knows like how to map any of that stuff out accurately. You're just kind of getting an idea. You're getting a I'm going to keep using these nautical references. You're sort of getting a true north and saying, okay, that's where we have to go. But you have this kind of wide cone that you can work in, and the ship can keep just steering all over the place. And you have to figure out, did you just make the correct turn or the incorrect turn? Are you going to hit an iceberg or not? And the possibility of hitting an iceberg is constant.
Well, it seems that in addition to, you know, having a lot of people at the studio, you yourself also wore a lot of individual hats on this project. You're not just like the head of the project. You also are working on the narrative. You're working on character development. Did you find that like even extra stressful, or did you find that invigorating? Kind of like the idea of a busy person always manages to get more done.
That's interesting. I never heard that. A busy person gets more done.
I've also never heard that. Is that a real saying?
I mean, yes.
I mean, the way you said it, I believe that it's a real saying now. See, I'm really into wearing hats. As people know, I like to wear the white hats. So that makes me want to wear a lot of hats. Actually, the reality is I was at another studio, and I told them how I believed sort of the director's job would work, kind of describing that you're connected to everything. And it isn't because you want to control everything, even though I have a slight controlling problem. it's a little one, and I'm working on it. There are so many decisions that seem inconsequential or small that if you don't understand the full sort of breadth of everything, you could make bad decisions that just start steering you incorrectly. And if you're unaware of those decisions, it's happening, again, with the nautical reference, the deck below you, you're not able to make the right decisions when you don't have the right information, right? So for me, it was important that you have to be involved. This is sort of the way that it's always been at Santa Monica. So looking at another studio, they're just like, oh, well, we've found that one person can't do all of that. They end up being a bottleneck. And I'm like, yeah, sometimes that's true. You are a bottleneck, but the reality is in order to truly, I think, be able to make good decisions, you have to understand everything that's going on. And I think in the beginning, I sort of gave the first two writers that were on the project kind of the carte blanche freedom. And I said, you know, here's the general idea. Where do you guys want to go with this? And they started writing. And every time I got drafts back, I was realizing that it's getting farther away from something that feels right. And it wasn't any sort of judgment on their abilities. They were incredible writers. But I was also not reacting quick enough, and I was letting the drafts come in and saying, you know what, I need to give them space and freedom to create this. But I was getting farther and farther away from what the narrative was, but also from what I think instinctively felt right, you know? So I had to make that decision late, unfortunately, that I was like, oh, we got to scrap this and start over because I don't think we're writing the second game. You know, we're writing a game that presupposes the relationship between the two characters is already figured out, right? And we're focusing on all the plot and all the characters and all the cool things about Norse mythology versus Kratos and Atreus are the core. And then we get to learn about all this other stuff through their experiences and everything being sort of centered around family. So that was an early sort of reminder to myself that I need to stay actively involved in everything. And I mean, it's all the way up to like working with the marketing group and how we message everything out, because, you know, we know more and the game changes every 4 seconds, right? And it's if you're not, if you're literally gone for a day, it's like, what game are we making? I don't even recognize this anymore. It's crazy.
So you're telling me you didn't take any time off in the whole, like, what, 5 years was it that you guys worked on the game?
I totally took time off.
Good.
But I just had that
you
sort of like...
You just came back and we're like, what?
Right.
What game is this?
Right. It was like a Harrison Ford Regarding Henry moment. I was like, what's happening here? I don't know. Who are all you people and what are you doing in my house?
Well, what you were talking about kind of leads to one of the questions that we got from Twitter from @fatality89, who says, what other studios were consulted, if any, in the making of God of War? And if so, in what regards to combat story and cinematics?
Well, we had spoken with Naughty Dog very early on, and this is...
Seems like a good call.
Yeah.
Well, it's interesting because the reasoning behind consulting Naughty Dog was the opposite of what you would think. It was one of the main programmers at the time, the lead programmer, really wanted to talk me out of doing a companion. He thought it was a real... He's like, this is a huge investment. I don't think you get what you're getting into. This is going to be a really difficult thing. We're going to have a team dedicated just to this character. You're going to have to cut a bunch of stuff. And that's usually, like, when people tell you have to cut stuff, that's the way that they know they're speaking to my heart and going, like, if I say that, he's going to listen to me. And I was like, it's fine. I spent a lot of time. It's fine. Don't worry about it. And they said, oh, you know what? I've arranged a meeting with the AI programmer over at Naughty Dog. So let's go over and talk to him, and he'll kind of talk to you about this. And it was a while since we had talked about him saying it was a bad idea to do this, so I thought, what a nice guy. He's totally setting this up to help me out, right?
Instead, I was hoping the guy would...
He was really hoping, yeah, he'd be like, this is going to be hard, right? This is the scared straight sort of moment, right? Getting sent to prison. And we go over there, and they're so nice, and they're telling me all about... the way that they were doing it, and kind of the mistakes, I think is the best way to put it. But it wasn't really mistakes; it was just they explored a path, right? And that path turned out to be kind of a dead end because they were overcomplicating it. They were thinking about it as something that was too big, and they kind of had this epiphany, which was very close to release, right? I don't know if you know about the story of that, but like really close to release for Last of Us. They decided, you know, Ellie's not working, and this is how Ellie needs to work. And they had come up with these, like, five rules. Instead of this huge sort of bloated sort of design document and this technical manual of everything, they were just like, look, as long as Ellie adheres to these five rules, I think it will work. And then they started getting good playtest feedback, and I think they had talked about it. There was a moment where Ellie had said, Joel, behind you. When they were hiding behind cover during a playtest, and it was like everybody, you know, gave it great scores, and it was literally just her saying a line at the right time that made him feel like she's real, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm like, oh, this is great information, and we left Naughty Dog, and the programmer goes, okay, so you see. It's going to be really hard. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's going to be great. This is going to be so easy.
All I said was there were five rules. That's
right.
It. Five.
I was like, five rules, man. This is going to be great. And obviously, it was way more complicated than I would have ever imagined in the beginning. But I sort of knew that if I didn't completely throw myself at that problem and say, like, look, we're just going to do this. I'm committed. It was that and the no-cut camera were the two that I was, you know, listening to everybody who had issue, but then also sort of replying back this idea of, trust me, I believe we can do this. Let's start to break down the problem. And, I, you know, rightfully so, the studio's apprehensive about both of those things because it's me assigning work to all of them, right? I'm coming up with something that is going to make their lives miserable for 5 years trying to figure out these problems. And, you know, thankfully it's just peaks and valleys. So there's a little bit of miserable, but a lot of these great realizations where people are like, did you know we could do this? Oh, this is so great. We had incredible people working on those problems and were able to kind of come up with clever solutions. We also have constantly been like talking to Gorilla. They're sort of good friends to our studio, and we hang out with their sort of developers all the time. And you know, every once in a while I've had a chat about how they would attack certain problems. Love to learn from their tools because they have really good tools. But I feel like as a developer, you kind of always say that about other developers. You're like, I hate my tools and your tools are great, right? It's the grass is always greener in other places. But I really do like that sort of more open environment. That's the first party sort of benefit. That's one of the biggest things I think that is great is that there's so many great first party studios that we can just say, hey, can I just stop by? You know, and, you know, God of War actually being successful has sort of afforded me the opportunity to actually go and stop by studios that are not first-party studios and ask questions and, you know, prod for information.
I feel like you're everywhere on Twitter. I feel like every time I open it up, you're at a new studio or you're at a new location.
I know, right? It's crazy. And I'm just keep going like, seriously, you're going to let me go there? Right? You're going to let me hang? Okay, great, right? I'm just going to keep pushing it because eventually it's going to stop and they won't let me do that. But, you know,
got you to were meet. Recently hanging out with Hideo Kojima talking about Death Stranding, right?
And maybe Miyazaki too, you know. But yeah, that was amazing, because I kind of was going to Japan for something else and just said, hey, look, I'd like to set up any studio visits that anybody can help me arrange, if for nothing else than to take a picture next to that statue in the hallway of Kojima Productions, because it feels it feels like a development rite of passage, yeah. Right? It's just like, yeah, like every other day.
There's wasn't enough, Corey.
Right, no, it's that picture. That lets you know, okay, I'm there, right? But yeah, that was awesome, because I've never hung out with him for a long period of time, right? I've seen him in the green room at E3 2016, and every once in a while we run into each other and say hi, but that was about it. And to spend like 2 hours when he was explaining his game and talking about how he feels about it and hearing the exact same sort of creeping doubt that we all have kind of coming through, I was like, oh my gosh, it's literally everywhere. We're all the same way.
The tiny bit of imposter syndrome.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's like you make something and you hope people, I think, relate to it and understand it and like it. You know, as much as I think a lot of people want to try to put on some armor in advance and be like, I don't care, I make games for myself, right? It's like, yeah, I don't think any of us do that. I don't care if it's even you make games by yourself. You still make games for other people, right? You make something for other people to enjoy. And it's tough if they don't, right? And that is always there, I think, in everybody's head. Doesn't matter who you are. Because there's so many film directors that are really amazing that you would think, if they said, I would like to do a movie about my grocery list, people would fund it, right? Yeah. But I've talked to tons of them. They're like, I've got 17 scripts in a drawer somewhere that nobody wants to make. I'm like, how could, if nobody wants to make those movies for you, there's no hope for any of us, right? How are we going to get anything done?
Do you think that doubt is just an inherent part of being a creative person or on the more, you know, artistic side of game development?
I think, yeah. I think anybody who puts themselves out there, and I think, you know, it does deal partially with the creativity, but when you put yourself out there as someone who's presenting something from you, right? And I mean, we're talking like physicists who go and present a paper, I think go through the exact same thing. Anytime you are putting yourself out to be judged by a small group of people or by the world, it's scary, right? And I think maybe at first, if you've had no experience with it, it's not scary because you don't know what the bad side can be. But once you have the bad side, then you're like, okay, that's always present. And I think the imposter syndrome is definitely a creative thing. But I think that is present, honestly, between anybody who is interacting with the public.
That's true. I mean, I know that we were super scared when we originally launched What's Good, like getting ready to hit that publish button, you know, for the very first time.
Maybe our parents will support us, maybe our husbands, maybe right. Some close friends, and we'll call it good.
Was there ever a point where you were like, you know what, let's not do it? No. That you had to talk yourself off the ledge?
It's not let's not do it. It was, like we said, kind of more like, well, we might do this and nobody may care, like, but I guess we'll just do it anyway. We'll just, like, we're going to see
if
how
If anything,
goes.
We'll have the audio podcast, right?
If anything, we're just doing this audio podcast. At the very least, it will be time for all of us to hang out, kind of.
Yeah.
So that was how we were going to frame it if we failed miserably.
Yeah. Kind of just, like, accept it gracefully, you know? Because, you know, one of the lessons I learned early in my career, which I think a lot of people have learned, is that if you're going to fail, fail quickly and then move on and start something else. You know, like you can't wallow in your failure.
Yes.
You know, because right. Then it just makes it worse.
And failure's not bad. Like right. that's the other thing. It happens.
That doesn't mean it is bad.
I mean, yeah, it feels bad, I think, when other people are pointing out your failure, yeah. Right? That are actually, yeah. You know, I think themselves sort of wallowing in your failure. But the reality is, failure is such an incredibly good tool, right? It is what gets you to success, right? Like any kind of success, whether it be a small or a large success, is born of multiple failures, of multiple ways to not do something, to do something very wrong, right? And I think that's the unfortunate part, I think, generally about our society is that a lot of people demonize or look poorly upon failure. And I think that's bad, right?
Like it's an end point, right? Once you feel right. Once, you can't keep going. What's that quote? I'm going to butcher it, but I haven't failed. I've just found a bunch of ways that haven't worked.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's that was the light bulb one,
yeah.
Right? I found like 20,000 ways not to make a light bulb. Like yeah. That's awesome. And that's the thing is like all of sort of the great achievements throughout human history were not one and done. They weren't like, wow, I did this once and it totally worked. Awesome.
I'm amazing.
Right. Actually, no, probably a bunch of YouTube videos or that like accidental, like, oh my God. And then they can never repeat it. But like the perfect basketball off the head into the hoop kind of thing. But that's what I mean.
It takes so many tries to get that shot.
Really?
Probably.
See, I would have thought it was just perfectly caught on video. You're messing up the illusion.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Oh, no. Oh, God.
Magic is no longer real. But yeah. Failure is super important. We should always celebrate failure. Maybe not for a long time, but
right. You know, yeah, I think. Yeah, I think what you're saying is just like we need to
failure.
Yeah, we all need to come to an understanding that it's going to be part of all of our lives, and we need to stop demonizing it as much as we have been,
or shying away from things that we think could get
we
us
might
there.
Fail at. Right?
Yeah,
right.
Totally. Yeah.
Exactly.
Totally. I'm like that. Literally, every time I have to do any public speaking thing, I'm mentally trying to figure out ways to get out of it. Right.
And so that's why this
so
took
what's
so
happening
long.
On Friday yeah, yeah. Yeah. You're gonna get a cold while you're here, like what's the excuse you got in your back pocket?
Yeah, I was like, oh, maybe I could tell people that I had to quickly take a flight home or something like that. Yeah, no,
and it always got loose in your house.
All the insects got loose in the house, and now I have to go help take care of it, even though I don't take care of any of those things.
All right, we've got another question here. This one is from @Deenitz, and it says, is there a feature @Deenitz? Devon Nitz is his full name.
Okay.
Is there a feature or aspect of God of War that you or the team loved and you wish more people knew about, or that most people didn't catch or notice about the game?
Wow. I don't know. People caught pretty much
the internet
everything about
finds
that.
Most things.
It comes to hate, but they find good about it.
I mean, the thing that bummed me out the most was that people found out the map. The physical map secret really fast. I was really hoping that would percolate for a while, kind of like the sort of Metal Gear nuclear disarmament thing.
Maybe I don't know what you're referring to. Physical map secret?
Oh, look at that. See? This is great. So I can tell you about it. Okay. So I was really enamored with like physical box products when I was a kid. Loved getting like those cloth maps, loved getting like the manuals and stuff like that, and kind of poring over it. And even though I hated the copy protection aspect of it, I liked the idea that you kind of had to reference the manual to say, what color is the pair of pants here to kind of get into the game. I just thought these were neat ways to kind of bring the physical real world into this game experience and kind of unify it. So I was like, oh, you know what? I want to do something that utilizes parts of our collector's edition and does kind of like an unlock inside the game, right? So we had these two little statue chess pieces of Brock and Sindri, and then I wrote this little story in runes on the cloth map, and then we kind of did this very faint grid on the cloth map, right? And on the cloth map, you could actually see on the bottom of these two chess pieces, there was a symbol on the bottom of one. And then if you read the story, it's a story about how Brock and Sindri had actually traveled the world and found this amazing artifact, but then hid it. And then across the top and across the bottom of the map were two languages. And this is where I got super confident, because we made the languages up. Okay, it wasn't like somebody could say, oh, well, I know that language, so I just deciphered it really quick. You have to actually play through the game, get the language discs to understand how to translate the runes that we made up to actually get the movement of each of the pieces. So you'd be playing this little game where you'd be following the movement and see the journey of Brock and Sindri throughout all the cloth map. And the final thing was talking about how they had hidden it between where they had last ended up. So then when those two pieces at the end of where the code was, you'd be standing by one of the places and you'd go, oh, if I go here, there's actually a code that you enter, which is facing something, look up, look down, like all this stuff that we could do. And that would actually unlock something inside the game. And I thought, oh, this would be so cool if somebody found this like 6 or 8 months after the release of the game.
How long did it take?
Right? That's like 4 days or something. Like that. It was so fast.
I remember reading about that. That's fascinating.
Yeah. It was so cool. And I had to keep it a secret inside the studio as well, because I didn't want a lot of people to know, because the more people that know, the more that would get out there.
Right. Yeah.
So at first, producers were getting very upset with me because they were just like, what is this Skunkworks thing you're doing about a map? I'm like, shh, don't say it in public here. right? So then we had like one designer, and then it got passed off to another designer, and we were able to keep it fairly secret in the studio. But it ended up being like the last secret people found was the one that I really figured people would find very quickly, which was the fact that Faye had written Loki in the house, which I love that. Like, I think it's such a cool way to sort of show that she always knew, right? It wasn't like we were just making this stuff up as we were going along, but she was always sort of representing both sides of who Atreus is.
That's really cool. I can't believe I totally missed that.
Yeah.
Just like, right over my head, I guess. Well, maybe it's because I didn't actually get to see the map in person. I don't even know if I know anybody that has that map.
I do.
You have it?
Of course I do.
Of course.
I was going to say,
well, I'm also a sucker for physical collector's editions and stuff like that.
Yeah. And the talking Mimir head. That one also almost did not make it in. So I had made a joke about it. In fact, most of the stuff we ended up doing was me making a joke, thinking they were never going to do it.
And then convincing somebody
and they
to
were
put
just
it
like,
in the game.
That's interesting. Yeah. But I wanted the Mimir head keychain that actually you could press multiple buttons or one button that would cycle through like 10 different phrases, right? And in the end, it was not going to be in. And then it was like this negotiation point of, okay, well, you can't have this, but how about I get you the Mimir head? And it can only say one thing. And I was like, oh, all right, yeah, that's cool. That works for me, because I didn't even want the other thing. Yeah. So it was like, what a great negotiation. I finally got it.
I didn't even want that other thing.
I was sort of joking about it.
Yeah, it's awesome. Like the life-size axe, the big foam axe. That was I had made a joke earlier on to say, that's what our collector's edition will be, just a big life-size axe. And they were like, ha. And then like 5 or 6 months later, somebody goes, you remember when you were joking about the life-size axe? I think we can do that. They're like, not for the collector's edition, but we can do that.
Because they were sold at the last PSX, weren't they?
Yeah, yeah.
Pretty sure I saw them there in the PlayStation store. So we have another question for you from
Twitter.
From Matt the Gamer. I'd love to know.
Matt the Gamer?
Matt the Gamer. Yeah. I'd love to know what existing franchise you would love to take a swing at, pun intended. It could be anything. Comics, movies, previous games. So like Pie in the Sky. If you could do like a dream project or anything that you would be able to work on.
Wow. Well, I have like two that for me, if they were like existing licenses, three. Man, this is hard. Okay. Well, I'll give you a whole host of things. One, I would absolutely love to do a Hawkeye, Kate and Clint kind of deal. I think they are two very interesting characters, Kelly Thompson and Matt Fraction, I think did some of the best sort of runs of those two characters, and love to do sort of an interesting dueling archers thing. Kelly also did this really great sort of West Coast Avengers thing, which I think has these fantastic sort of irreverent characters, excellent dialogue. But you know, I am a huge fan of the movie Willow.
Oh my gosh. I love Willow. I'm so glad you said that.
Yes,
I literally
so
told
good.
John that I want to name our first daughter Aurora because of it.
Oh, fantastic. That
because,
is
well,
awesome.
Her name's Allura. I go back and forth.
Allura Danon.
Between Allura and Aurora. Yeah. Sleeping Beauty is my favorite Disney movie. But
just combine them.
Yeah. No, Allura's the best.
Yeah. And for me, I watched that movie so many times when I was a kid. And I've always like imagined like, you know, it'd be really, I'd love to remake that like in the gaming space, right? To do something interesting with that. Not necessarily the exact thing, not like a sort of a Gus Van Sant shot for shot remake of Psycho or anything, but like, you know, expand upon it, maybe do something completely different with it, but sort of use that foundational license. That would be awesome. And then Star Trek. Mm. I would absolutely love to do like a story of the Klingons, right? Of like, you know, to Stovacor and back, right? Kind of a To Hell and Back sort of vibe, telling a story of like a group of Klingons. That would be really interesting.
That would be really unique and different. I feel like the Klingons never get their time in the spotlight.
Right? Yeah. See, there you go.
There you go.
There you go, Matt the Gamer.
May it happen.
All right. So this one is kind of like that, but a little bit of a twist. This one's from at Maison Osroff, and it says, we are in the midst of the Harry Potter controversy. So, Corey, would you be interested in writing a book revolving in the universe, and what would it be like? Which subject and character would he want to explore? Now, I'm going to assume, Maison, that you mean in the God of War universe, not in the Harry Potter
universe. Okay, good. I was going to ask for clarification on that one. And then we just sit here and wait for him to tweet back. Okay, so a book in the God of War universe revolving around another
character. A subject or character.
Yeah. Oh, I would absolutely love to do that. I mean, I have a bunch of ideas of stories that I want to tell between God of War 3 and this game. There's a lot of really cool things that I sort of was imagining that were feeding into who the character of Kratos was today. I really, really would love to write a book about Brock and Sindri before they meet, and kind of their relationship with Faye, and kind of a way to lead up to the first meeting of Kratos and Faye. So instead of making something solely just about that, but making it this kind of like interesting story about Brock and Sindri and then how they intersect with Faye, and then how in turn that sort of intersects with Kratos. And you kind of get this sort of, not really Rosencrantz and Guildenstern are dead, but a little bit in that way, because you're kind of really focusing on these two characters who I think are incredibly interesting.
They were really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. And those ones, we had taken the reference from the mythology. Brock and Sindri are two dwarves that actually did make Mjolnir. And when I was talking to the writers, I said, all right, so I have two characterizations for these guys, and there'll be our starting point of where we're going to go with this thing. And I'm like, just roll with me on this one, because I know it's going to sound silly and stupid. I'm like, but the boat captain from Jaws meets Al Swearengen is one of the characters. And I think at the time, I didn't even assign it to whether it would be Brock or Sindri. I had just said, like, okay, it's kind of those two characters. And I'm like, he's just going to swear constantly. It's going to be like an art form for him, right? He's just going to be foul and angry and ornery. And then I was like, maybe drunk as well. I don't know. And then I said, then the other one is going to be like Adrian Monk, right? That he is just going to be like the wizard when it comes to smithing, but literally afraid of everything, right? And it was going to be the rationalization of fairies, right? That germs for him were fairies, right? That all these sort of magical unseen things were actually what we call sort of germs and bacteria today. And he's just hypersensitive to that. And at first they were like, I don't know about this.
Not really feeling the vision here.
And then after like a day or two, they came back and they were like, oh no, I think there's some cool stuff we can do with this. And then we started talking about the potential backstory. And I had written something that talks about how Sindri became the germaphobe that he was. And I was like, oh, I really want that story to be its own thing too. I think it ended up being a little bit in the game, but there's so much more cool stuff that we could do.
So you have Brock and Sindri, who you pitch, and at first people are like, I don't know. You have this no-cut camera. At first people are like, I don't know. And then you have this companion. I don't know. So what's that like to see all of that happen so successfully? Did they come back with like a cake and are like, you were right, Corey?
No cake. You know, it's interesting. There was a contingent of people who were saying, hey, this is great. Yeah, I can get behind it. But I think it was never the same people for each individual thing. Mm-hmm. It was always some individual groups. And perhaps it corresponded with the group that would get hit the hardest with whatever work it was.
Sure.
So the programmers far more invested with saying, companion, no, animators with the no-cut camera. But it was interesting. At the end of the game, because I had told with the no-cut camera, I pretty much was like, guys, this isn't going to be able to be proven until the whole game is able to be played. I'm like, because I can show you a clip and show you why I think it's going to be good, but it's the culmination of the experience that gives you the sense that this was a very personal journey that you're going on. You never get to look away. I'm like, so we won't be able to know until the end, but trust me, I'm feeling very strong about this one. And all the way up to like E3 2016, there were still a bunch of people who were like, this is not a good thing. You know, the programmer told me not to talk about it. A different programmer this time, the technical director had said, don't talk about the no-cut camera just in case we can't do it. And I was like, that is the exact reason I'm going to talk about it now.
In your face.
Right. I'm going to put it out there so we have no choice. We are committed. Right. But yeah, at the end of the game, it was interesting to see a lot of people come in. More interesting was the people who never spoke up and said anything. So people who I just thought were like, wow, that person is so supportive. Because they didn't say anything.
Or they really just quietly
Right.
Rumbling.
But then they'll come in and be like, dude, I just got to say, for years, I was thinking you were crazy and this wasn't going to work. And I was like, why is he doing this? This is dumb. This is a lot of extra work. But I just played the game. This pretty much happened in 2018 at the beginning of the year. So everybody had played over the holiday. So the entire team took the build home. Everyone had played the entire game. And I just started getting people filing in the office and saying, like, oh, my God, this actually did work. It was really cool. I see now why you wanted to do this. And I was like, awesome. Thank you. We're done now. So that's not fully helping me, but that's cool. But, yeah, in the end, I think most of the doubt for them just came from
the workload.
Yeah, the workload. Yeah. It feeling like, you know what, I don't know how we're going to solve this. And that's honestly what we all go through, I think. We want to feel comfortable, but some of us don't see that we're going to feel uncomfortable that we feel so comfortable, mm-hmm. but it's going to be too late.
Yeah.
So a lot of the times in the beginning, you have to make these sort of big proclamations to yourself and say, you know what, we're going to take this thing on, we're going to do it. Because when you get to a point where you're like, man, this was really easy, and I wonder, did we play hard enough? Did we push hard enough? Did we do everything? And unfortunately, you're going to say that anyway. It doesn't matter what you do. You're going to get to the end, and there's that scary, scary, like, your moment of publish, right? Mm-hmm. That it is that sense of, like, okay, I can no longer touch this, and now I'm racked with, like, insecurity and doubt of, like, did I do enough? Did it was this enough? And then you're just sort of mentally reading the negative feedback that you're going to get, right? Remembering some of the really negative feedback you get in playtests throughout the year. Years, like, we had of people just saying, this is terrible, you're ruining the franchise.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, Kratos picking flowers was my favorite response. Flowers? And then, like, he capitalized flowers and then said it again with, like, 5X. I'm like, flowers?
Like, it really was, hates flowers.
I had ruined the character so much because Kratos was asked by Freya to go pick flowers. Spoiler alert, by the way. Yeah. He picks flowers. But yeah.
He only has one tone. Don't you know this? And it's angry shouting. Yeah. That's
yes.
it.
That's it.
You can be nothing else.
Angrily.
And he was flowers. Angry about going to pick flowers yeah, as well, like, right?
You can angrily pick flowers. Right. Exactly. That's an emotion you can have.
Chris, actually, I think the first take we did of that...
You're talking about Christopher
Chris
Judge.
Chris yeah. Judge. This was, I think, one of our earlier scenes. And he had not told anybody about this. I think this was just an improv thing for him. But he kind of did that scene. And then when he was going out, we were going to have this thing where he kind of pushes against something as he was walking out. But we ended up abandoning that idea. And then we did the take again. And he kind of... She says, yeah, just out in the garden, can you go get it? He's like, fine. You know, lamb's crest. And he turns around and he goes, I'm the fucking god of war. I should not do this. So hilarious. I was like, oh, I wish we could keep that. That's so good.
For the blooper reel, I guess.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, Corey, this has been really fun.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for making the time to come down here during GDC.
Absolutely.
I know that you've got a lot going on this week. Is there anything or any other talks that you're looking forward to going to up at the convention center?
There are so many people on the God of War team that are talking this week. I'm hoping to go out and try and see every one of them. So yeah, that, and I think Brian's giving a talk, Brian Intihar.
From Insomniac.
Yeah, from Insomniac, fantastic director. He's giving a talk on Thursday. Excited to go check that out. Yeah, and then see as much as I can, hang out with people, and that would be good. And then I guess finish my talk.
Yeah, that's probably yeah. should be on the list at some point.
I should really do that.
Making slides.
It's okay. You can get inspired by all of these other talks you're going to go see, and you're going to be like, oh, I should weave that into my talk.
Oh, my God,
talk.
I'm going to steal from everybody else's talk. That's amazing. Yeah,
steal slides from everybody else's presentation.
Oh, my God, that'd be amazing.
Yours, like,
right. You may recognize
there.
This slide from Brian Intihar's talk. Hey, so I have to ask. When you guys were starting this thing, did you, like, try out different sort of, well, I don't know what they call it when you say, what's good, everybody? So you're sort of, like, log like on, you're sign on. Like,
oh,
did you
yeah.
try different ones? Did you workshop them? Did you find ones that didn't work? How did you end up with that one?
Didn't we just kind of wing everything and hope for the best?
We did. If you go back and watch some of our early shows, they're kind of a hot mess.
Yeah.
We've just come like a long this. Way. We're mm-hmm. about to hit episode 100 of our show, which is very exciting. And we have gotten into a groove over the many months months that we've been doing the show now and kind of figuring out, you know, how the flow wants to work. I think the one thing that we knew needed to be consistent week to week was the segments and the content. So that way our audience wasn't always being confused about what was happening on the show. So they know when they come to What's Good Games, like they're going to get a breakdown of news analysis first, and then they're going to get the games that we've gotten previews with or hands-on time with, and then they're going to get a really fun feature segment at the end of the show.
And randomly breaking out into song.
Well, they're going to get that all the time.
That's your jam, right? Yeah.
Exactly. We call that the funny stuff as part of our tagline.
The funny stuff. I like that.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's interesting how you evolved that over time, like the intro bit, and now it's down pat.
Yeah,
it seems really tight. That's why I was like, I wonder what the lineage of that is, right?
Well, I think just like over time, she just kept adding a little, like, and then it just came together. Yeah.
Well, I think we also needed to find our voice a little bit too and figure out like what was going to be our signature, our calling card, the reason why people want to come back to our show. And so I think our fans and the community members of What's Good Games helped us find that as well by saying, you know, like, this is the part of the show that I like, and this is the part of the show that makes me keep coming back week after week. So
that is literally the best thing, to be able to interact with people who are actually enjoying and consuming what you're doing, to give you feedback to help you sort of know where to go. I mean, that's awesome.
Our community is simply the best. They are wonderful people who are incredibly supportive of what we do. And, you know, like any creative property, there's always going to be naysayers out there, but we've done a really good job of really pushing them aside and being like, mute, we don't want to hear from you anymore.
The banhammer is one sometimes.
Yeah. The banhammer.
She's very good at swinging that hammer.
I'm not afraid to either.
Word to the wise, don't cross Brittany Brumbucker.
See, now I consider that a challenge. I want to get banned.
Oh, it's not hard.
Right. It's really not hard.
Make like a dummy account to do that.
And then you just send us a really sweet email apologizing for all your transgressions, and then maybe I'll let you back in the community.
But then you would unban me, and then I wouldn't have the sort of notoriety of being banned. But you're right, make the burner account.
Yeah, yes.
Oh, all right.
No, I feel like I need to be the reasonable one here to say that. Maybe this isn't the greatest idea.
Like, we shouldn't be plotting to do this.
I'm like, please don't troll us, Corey.
No.
I think you'd be able to tell.
You'd be able to tell. I would use my own account, probably.
Yeah, no, you would.
It's like, thank God you don't know who this is.
I changed my picture.
At Corey Marlowe. Right. Well, thank you so much again for coming down. We hope that you guys enjoyed this special episode. You, of course, can find Corey on Twitter. As he mentioned, you are constantly tweeting with Anna. Yes. And it's really fun to watch your guys' shenanigans back and forth.
Yes.
Can I ask, what's up with the insects in your
house? You know, she is very into lizards and insects and snakes. And at one point she had rabbits, but we have a small place, so rabbits just tear everything up. So that did not last long. Our wedding anniversary just passed, and I gave her two jumping. Oh, thank you. Yeah, and two. You know, the 7th wedding anniversary is the jumping spider anniversary.
Wait, jumping spiders?
That sounds terrifying.
Two jumping spiders. Yeah. I'm not really excited about them. You know, I'm really.
I was like interested in the mantises, like the flower one she has is really pretty. Yep. Even like the spiky one's cool looking.
They're slow moving.
Jumping spiders, I would not be down with.
Yeah, and immediately they lived up to the namesake. I mean, I was in I think it was in Austin when they arrived, and immediately it jumped onto Hilo, and he kind of freaked out a little bit, but he loves the bugs. That's their bonding thing. They have a really good sort of bond, furthering the idea that they are Kratos and Atreus, and I am Faye. She's super into that, and like she sold me on the mantis because she's sort of a little picture. Like, see, oh, look at this little thing. It's like this big now. Sincerely, at some point I think it's just going to sit at the table and eat with us.
That's probably a ruler size, so probably close to a foot. You would say 12
it's ridiculous. Okay, it's not that big, but it's big, right? And every time they molt, they get bigger, right? And I think they only last about a year, but man. It really is Silence of the Lambs in our house at this point.
Oh my gosh.
It's really crazy.
We have pet insects in the studio. We have Tangerine, or Nectarine, right there in the corner.
Oh, there you go.
He's moved across the studio.
What up, Tangerine?
Yeah.
We actually used to have a daddy long legs that Brittany named Kratos.
Oh.
We don't know where he is, though, so he's probably shriveled up somewhere.
Right.
Up there.
Maybe he just went somewhere else.
He went to the north.
Yeah.
I think he's got a few things coming up. Yeah. You know?
He's got to go prepare.
He's got to prepare, right?
All right. Well, you guys know where to find us, whatsgoodgames.com/podcast or youtube.com/whatsgoodgames. Be sure to give us a like, a rating. If you guys want to subscribe to the podcast, we'd appreciate that as well. And we'll be back later this week with a special episode from GDC with Megan Scavio, the president of the Academy of Interactive Arts and Sciences. It's going to be a good one.
That is going to be a good one. I will be watching that one.
Fantastic. All right, everybody. We will see you next time.